South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
Well, a very good morning across South Texas and the Hill Country, or wherever you might happen to be listening on the internet. Here we are, first, almost through with a week of January 2024. That just seems so hard to believe. And boy, hadn't it been pleasant compared to some of the winters we've had lately. And I tell you, I think everybody's happy with a little cool after the kind of summer we had. But hopefully, we're into El Nino. Hopefully, we're going to continue to get some moisture and move back into a pattern of moderate weather. Sure, it'll be hot in the summer, but maybe not so hot. And it'll be cool in the winter, but hopefully not frigidly cold. And we all get back to gardening the way that we did for quite a few years before this little hiccup we had in our typical weather starting back in 2021. But anyway, lots of interesting things to talk about. But what is of most interest to me is what you would like to talk about. Looks like we have Russell and Victor and Debbie ready to talk. Anybody who wants to grab that last line at 210-599-5555. But let's get started with phone calls. Good morning, Russell.
Good morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
Today, and I've come up with some more questions. So
that's what I'm here for.
here goes. Sweet potatoes. I've heard you talk about it, but I didn't write anything down or anything. But I think you said you get the potato and put toothpicks in and stick it in water. And
right.
And let it. And then how long before you're going to plant do you do that?
Probably at least a month. Sweet potatoes are hot weather plants. You know, we plant our white potatoes usually in February. Sweet potatoes, yeah. It's usually going to be April or May. So, you know, sometime mid to late March is when you can get your potato vine started, so to speak. And you'll want the little individual vines, and you'll have quite a number of them come off of a good sized sweet potato. Yeah, you want them to get 6 or 8 inches long, and then with a very sharp knife, you just kind of take out a little wedge of the potato itself, and that's what we call a slip. And some people go directly into the garden with those. Some people will put that in perlite and let it root for a little while. But, yeah, it's a whole different story growing sweet potatoes it is from growing your typical baking potato or new potato. But lots of fun and lots of good eating.
And can you put those in a bag or no?
In it like a grow bag?
Yeah, a grow bag.
I think that's by far the best way to grow them. Now, I don't like the... Go ahead.
Go around, just round and round in the bags as it grows?
Let it go
outside.
Well, it's better, I think, to keep it contained because the potatoes don't develop right at the base of the plant. They do with other types of potatoes. They may be 5 feet away. They may be 10 feet away from where your plant is actually growing. And you don't really want to have to go dig up the whole garden to figure out where your sweet potatoes are. Now, I don't think you'll be successful using, you know, a little 10-inch grow bag. That's simply not big enough. But nowadays you can get these fabric beds, and they're good for several years. They're made of very durable materials these days. And what I've grown sweet potatoes in, they make a round one that's about 6 feet in diameter. And that's what I found to be the perfect size. And I'll put 3 to 5 slips in one, in one bag. And I'll end up with, 15, 20 potatoes when I do it that way. But putting in a good soft soil in that bed, I just kind of go probe around with my index finger. And when the potatoes are up to an appropriate size, just take them out and enjoy them.
So the vine has to stay in contact with the soil. You don't, as it goes around, then that's what happens. It roots and then grows the potatoes that way.
No, they grow off the basic root system of the vine. The vine doesn't normally form roots, and it doesn't have to touch the ground. I mean, you could grow it in a raised bed. You could grow it anywhere you like and just let the vine grow where it wants. But I would want an area. Yeah, I would want an area that's a minimum of maybe 3 feet by 3 feet to let the root system grow adequately and produce the yam, the potato, whatever you want to call it. And they can continue to grow and get bigger over quite some time. I remember seeing a sweet potato one time that I think weighed 46 pounds. So wow. You just keep up with the size as it goes along and take them out when they're appropriate size. But it's not something you're going to grow in a 10-inch pot.
One of the coworkers, they grew some. They had it out in their garden, and they dug them, and it was like a year later, then they found another one, and it everything was big in that. Anyway, and when you do the sweet potatoes around here, I don't know of any of the nurseries that carry them, so just get organic potato at the store.
You can get them at the grocery store. I know that Fanick's Nursery, they're probably size-wise, they're the biggest and oldest nursery in San Antonio. I envy them their 10 acres, although I'm also glad I don't have to look after that much nursery. But Fanick's frequently has sweet potato slips, or you can actually order them online.
Okay. And when I do the water thing to grow them, do you need to put anything like has to grow in
no,
the water?
No, okay. Typically not. You will change the water periodically because it can get pretty foul, as you might imagine. But if you want to put a little bit of has to grow in, it certainly won't hurt anything. But consider the size of the potato, and that potato is basically just starchy nutrition for the vine. So it came with a pretty big built-in food supply.
Okay. And then on red potatoes, I got some yesterday, and I'm not going to plant them for a while. Is there anything I can do to make the eyes grow bigger before I do the cutting and everything?
You don't want to make the eyes grow bigger because they're very fragile.
Okay.
Even if they just begin to swell, it's real easy to break them off, because you're going to take your seed potato and cut it in, depending on the size, from 2 to 6 pieces, and try to have 2 eyes in each piece. But at that point, you need to cauterize the cut surfaces. I've used wood ashes. I've used rock phosphate. Either one of those works well. But believe me, you really don't want them growing at that point, or you'll end up busting the eyes off of them trying to get them, properly coated and then into the ground.
And then growing celery, what time of year do you plant that?
About 2 months ago. You can still plant it now. It's a cool weather plant. If you plant it, if it gets very hot while it's growing, it tends to get bitter. And be aware, there is a leaf celery, which people grow just for using in salads and things like that. And then there is your celery, which makes the typical celery stalk that you're used to. Plenty of time to grow the leaf celery, and look in your crystal ball and tell me when it's going to get hot. And I'll tell you whether you've got time to grow the other. But typically we would have started that back in about October.
October, okay. All right, yeah, that's I didn't know. I was at the feed store here a few weeks back, and I saw the seed, and I thought, well, I never tried celery. I thought I'd give it a try, and then I don't know.
You can give it a
list, and I didn't see celery on the list, so I didn't know, but okay.
It's kind of one of those obscure things not a lot of people grow. We actually get plants of it. We get it in 3-inch pots all the time, so if you don't want to fool with seeds starting this late, call around to wherever you normally shop and see if your nurseries have it in with their bedding plants.
Okay. All right, Bob, I know you got more callers, so I'll let you go. I appreciate it.
Good questions, Russell. I appreciate the call this morning. You have a good Sunday, and we'll talk again. And, Don, let's go ahead and talk to Victor before we take a break. Good morning, Victor.
Good morning, Bob. Happy New Year. I just have one question.
Yes, sir.
I have that ground corn. Now, we've been doing our oak trees. Would it benefit the crepe myrtles and the we have an old ash tree there, and would it benefit the roses and other plants?
Not really. It benefits plants that are susceptible to different fungal problems. We do it for the oak trees because of oak wilt, which of course is a fungus. We do it for things like tomatoes for the early blight. We do it for, roses for mildew problems. But most other woody trees and shrubs, not really going to benefit a lot from it. I guess with crepe myrtles, you might prevent a little bit. You might prevent a little bit of mildew, but the mildew spores just float through the air. Your cornmeal's down on the ground. If you wanted to do something that would benefit your crepe myrtles with cornmeal, you would soak your whole ground cornmeal overnight in water and then spray the foliage with that, we just call it corn water tea, and that would very definitely benefit crepe myrtles, very definitely benefit roses, other things that are susceptible to, foliar diseases. But just sprinkle it on the ground, no. You do it on your oak trees, do it around your rose bushes, do it around your tomato plants, but don't worry about your oaks and elms and crepe myrtles and things like that.
Oh, okay. Okay, Bob. Thank you so much, and we will be talking to you soon.
I look forward to it, Victor. Happy New Year to you. And Debbie, hang on just a second. You will be up next. Right now, I get to really shift gears and talk about a little bit about your personal health. And, oral health is so important. They say good oral health will add 10 years to your life. I know it will add quality. It makes life more fun. I've known friends that had really serious dental issues, and can get pretty frustrating because you're getting sitting around from specialist to specialist to take care of all these different problems. Most of the guys and gals coming out of dental school these days are taught, hey, if it's more than a cleaning or a filling, send them out to a specialist. Wouldn't it be nice to just have a dentist who could take care of all those problems right there in his office? A guy that you can really consider your friend as well as your dentist. Really friendly atmosphere and such a capable, trained professional. Dr. Williamson's been at it for a lot of years, and he trained, extensive training, and then worked with Dr. Staffel when he was alive. And the man is simply, he's the go-to guy. He's the guy other dentists go to. If you'd like that sort of dentist in your life, just need to give his office a call. Maybe you're new to town. Maybe your dentist is retired or moved elsewhere. It's just nice to have somebody that can be your friend as well as your dentist, and somebody that can take care of any of your dental needs, simple or complex, right there in his office. Conveniently located out on Cherry Ridge Drive, just north of 410, just east of I-10, out in that little section. And just a wonderful office. 341-2569. If you're looking for a great dentist, remember that number, Dr. Mark Williamson and Associates, 341-2569.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. The guys had their turn with Russell and Victor. Now it's the ladies' turn with Debbie and Judy. Debbie's first in line. Good morning, Debbie. Debbie, are you there?
Morning with us. And
very good. Yes.
Hey, I wanted to find out on putting new flower beds in, because I'm trying to build my yard now. The builder put Bermuda grass in on top of rock. They didn't put dirt under it. They put
typical.
The dirt next door, and the grass for next door they put in my yard by mistake. So on my
Wow.
What do I want? Half an inch of dirt on top? You need four-wheel drive to cut my grass.
Yeah, you just want compost. You don't really want to bring in more dirt. You just create a muddy mess. Let your soil build itself up. Every spring, if you can, put maybe half an inch of compost on, and your grass will do better than it ever has. It will not demand as much water in the summer. It'll be more disease resistant, but you tend to bring in problems when you bring in dirt per se. Even good quality soil can have nuts edge in it, can have a lot of different things that you really wouldn't want. So I would just aim it once or even twice a year, top dress it with compost, and stop worrying about it.
When is the best time to do that, spring and fall?
You're exactly right. The only time that's not good to do it is when the temperatures are up in the 90s or above, because then it produces enough ammonia gas that it can cause a little bit of yellowing. But pretty much from about mid-September to usually mid-May, you've got a pretty wide window of time to get it done.
So even now is okay. It won't hurt the grass.
Oh, no. Now's a great time to do it. And you'll get the added benefit doing it at this time of year. Compost, good compost contains a natural, what we call a pre-emergent herbicide that keeps a lot of weed seeds from sprouting. Putting on a layer of compost early in the season, you will have a lot fewer problems with dandelion and henbit and, oxalis, all those things your neighbors are going to be dealing with. Putting out your compost now, you're going to really minimize those issues as well as helping your grass. You're not going to see on Bermuda especially, it's not really going to start growing above the ground until the soil warms up substantially. But the root system will benefit. The root system will grow enormously over the next 2 or 3 months thanks to the compost, the humic acids, the fulvic acids, all the good things that are in there. So you're not going to see a lot of change on top of the ground, but when it does start growing, when the soil and the weather get warm, you probably have the biggest, prettiest lawn you've ever had.
Do you have a place that you recommend getting good compost from, Gardenville or any?
Gardenville does a lot of biosolids compost these days, which I don't care for. It's not that it's it doesn't bother me that it's human waste, but there's so much toxic material from pharmaceuticals to, you know, pesticide residues in the waste stream these days that I prefer a manure base or a vegetable based compost. What part of town do you live in?
New Braunfels.
In New Braunfels. Probably the closest place to you, there's a place out on I-35 called Site, S-I-T-E, Site 1, and they took over what was a chain called Stone and Soil Depot, and from what I've seen, they've maintained the quality pretty well. I suspect that's going to be the closest one to you. If you wanted to, you could call over to the plant house and ask Weston or whoever if there's anyone else around that they use and recommend, but I think you probably find Site 1 to be the closest. It's going to have good quality, and just tell them you want a manure-based compost, not a biosolids based.
Okay, and I used to hear you advertise Stone and Soil Depot.
Yeah, I used to. They, I think I created so much business for them, they didn't need to advertise anymore. So, and then, like I say, they sold to this, this other company, but they seem to be focused on quality as well. So, that's the best I know of. Now, San Antonio and West San Antonio, there are a couple other choices, but you don't want to pay a delivery charge all the way to New Braunfels.
Oh, got it. So regarding flower bed, I mean, we want to put in a garden, a raised garden. But regarding flower beds, because I want to attract hummingbirds and butterflies, do I want to put those against my house in the backyard or out along the edge of the fence? I don't want to attract termites and mold.
You're not likely to attract problems, but keep in mind that most flowers and virtually all vegetables need to have a good deal of sunlight. And, if you're on the east side or west side of your house, you're probably you can do fine putting beds right up against the house. But, north side's not going to get a lot of light in the summer months. So north or south side, I probably would do, especially in my vegetable garden, out away from the house. Now, it's okay to have a small bed up along, foundation bed up along the house, because they're both flowers and shrubs that will grow, you know, in the shade. Our building here at Shades of Green faces due north, but we have holly fern, we have foxtail, we have aspidistra, we have akuba. There are a lot of things like that, but in the sunnier areas, you'll just have a wider choice of what you can plant. So, especially on your vegetable garden, especially on your perennial beds, I'd want to be out far enough from the home that it's not in the shadow.
Okay, well, I definitely would not put the vegetables by my windows, but I would put the flowers.
There are some herbs that you might do, but not your veggies.
Well, I appreciate you. Thank you so much, and have a good
day. You do the same. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. Thank you.
Bye.
Goodbye. I think we've got time to talk to Judy before we take a break. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
My question is, when is the time to plant bare root roses?
Time to plant bare root roses is right now. Time to plant bare root roses is when you can find quality plants, and cool months are best. December, January, February. those are the months that are the best to plant, and those are the month that you will usually find the best supply of roses. Now, be very careful where you get those roses, and because don't just go by the name of the rose, because you know, you can take a familiar rose. If we took an old-fashioned rose, it might be the Peace Rose or a red rose like Oklahoma or Mr. Lincoln or something like that. But that same rose can be grafted onto any number of different rootstocks. And the companies that produce roses over around Lindale and Tyler in East Texas, they're growing on a rootstock meant for sandy, slightly acidic soils, and we do not have those in this area. So don't be tempted by the roses you see at the grocery store or the box store or wherever else, because they're probably, even though they're a familiar name, they're probably on a rootstock that won't do well here. If you're getting them from most of the California companies, and that would be Weeks or Armstrong or Jackson Perkins, they tend to use rootstocks that are much more adaptable to the soils that we have, you know, here in our part of Texas. So be careful where you get your roses, excuse me, and have the bed ready. Be able to plant them pretty much as soon as you get them, and absolutely do not allow the root system to dry out. If a rose's root system gets totally dry one time, the plant is probably dead. So be ready for them before they arrive. But again, be very careful where you buy your bare root roses, because, like I say, even though they may have a familiar name and may be a good rose, if they're grafted onto the wrong rootstock, they'll do very poorly for you here. Does that make good sense?
Yes, it does. And I bought all mine at Walmart, you know, in the plastic. I did. I don't have much choice down here. So.
Sure. Well, look and see the name of the company that they came from. Obviously, Walmart doesn't grow their own roses. And and look and see. If they, again, if they're from East Texas, I'd take them back. If they are a California company, then you're probably okay.
Okay. And my other question, how do I keep the cardinals from tapping on my window every day?
You know, there. Go to a good bird store or a good nature store somewhere. The cardinals are, you know, attacking their own reflection is what they're doing. And they actually have a decal that you can't see it. It's kind of like these, you know, you look at the buses these days and they're covered up with advertising, but if you're sitting inside the bus, you can't see it. And it's kind of the same way they make a decal that the birds can see that makes them want to stay away from that window, but you don't see it. And that's probably one of the few ways that you're going to slow them down. They're crazy. they tap on your windows. They sit there and tap on the outside mirrors on your car, and unfortunately sit there and poop on them while they're at it. But other than putting up a physical barrier, some of these kind of invisible little appliques that you can put on, that's probably the best way to encourage them to go elsewhere.
I mean, they go from window to window to window.
Oh, I know. I know. They have a high reproductive rate, and I think that's because Mother Nature realized they're not the brightest bird in the book. So it's a shame, but people with many windows will frequently find a dead cardinal now and then. They fly into their reflection so hard sometimes they knock themselves out and sometimes do even more damage than that. But they're sure pretty. They're just not the the highest IQ in the bird world.
But they were quite a nuisance over Christmas with my guest tapping at 6 in the morning.
been there, done that.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're certainly welcome, Judy. Get out and have a good Sunday. And I do have some open lines. If you've been getting a busy signal, grab one of those lines, 210-599-5555. And I want to talk about your health once again. And this time I'm going to talk about Rhonda's Nature's Way. You know, in the world we live in today, unless you've got a giant vegetable garden and time to tend it, you probably are not getting all the nutrition you need, maybe you have some issues. I mean, the cedar got me this year like it's never gotten me before. I've always just had minor allergy issues, which I took care of with something I got from Rhonda called Seasonal Allergy Relief. This year, I was sure thankful for that product called Cedar X that she carries. And in this world where COVID's rebounding, where, you know, it's cold and flu season and everything else, you want to keep your immune system strong. Rhonda's got products that... there's one in particular that I take every day. She also has something that will really kick your immune system into high gear very quickly, you know, if you really, really want to build things up. And I would certainly recommend it if you're getting on an airplane or going to a big party with a couple hundred people there, like I was last night. It's just when you're out in that kind of crowd, you really want to be sure your immune system's there to take care of you. Masks don't work. That's pretty much been proven. Your own immune system is the best thing you can do. And Rhonda's got products that will help you build your immune system and keep it strong. And if you have issues with sleep or digestion or even mood, natural things. You don't need to run to the doctor for a prescription. Rhonda can help you in so many ways. And this time of year, if you decided to take a few pounds off, go see her. She's got products that will help. She's got things that actually taste really good, but without all the sugars and calories. So many reasons to see Rhonda. Can't go see Rhonda and her staff today because they're always closed on Sundays. But other major holidays, Monday through Saturday, you'll find her in the shop over there in the shopping center at the corner of I-10 and Callahan, kind of across the parking lot from Sprouts. Remember that name, Rhonda's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. I guess we're back to the guys segment again because we've got Vic and Bruno and David. Vic's first in line. Good morning, Vic.
Hi, Bob, and thank you for taking my call. I sure enjoy your show, and I've appreciated all the help you've given over the years.
Well, believe me, I appreciate your call.
A couple of questions. The first is, we've just planted about 1,000 Asiatic jasmine, replaced them after 25 years, and
okay.
We've got a terrible weed problem, so I need to put down some kind of mulch, and I don't want to use the bark mulch or anything that's going to stay. So what could I put down to help me fight the weeds while the jasmine grows back in solid?
And you know the old saying, the first year it sleeps, second year it creeps, and the third year it leaps. So what are you fighting? Grassy weeds? Are you fighting dandelions? Are you fighting the himbit or spurge?
Everything.
Do you have any?
Everything.
Okay. Well, the only thing that's going to be a real big issue for you is going to be Bermuda grass or some kind of grass trying to encroach from the yard. So those are things that you're probably going to have to physically work at controlling. You can apply either a natural pre-emergent herbicide, which, as the name implies, has to go on before the seeds sprout, like corn gluten meal. It's sold on under two or three different names. I think the spreadable form probably works best, and it has a secondary benefit of being a pretty good fertilizer for your jasmine. Or you can just use a thin layer of a manure-based compost, which also works as a natural pre-emergent and also doesn't have all the nitrogen in it that corn gluten meal would, but has, you know, a lot of good basic things. If I was just using compost, I'd probably put out a little Growing Green or, you know, one of the other good organic fertilizers along with your compost. If you're doing the corn gluten meal, I'd again add just a little bit of compost to that. But those are going to be your two very best things to stop the weeds from ever getting started. Now, once the jasmine is well established, and that's probably going to be 6 months or so, I wouldn't do it right now, but once the jasmine gets established, you can make a very dilute orange oil solution and spray on, and that's going to knock out most all of your tender weeds. But I'd want to have my jasmine pretty well established because it'll be a minor setback to the jasmine, but if you make it really dilute and if the jasmine's got some good roots down, you're not going to even notice that you've done it, except that it's going to burn the weeds. But for now, I would, I would either go with a spreadable corn gluten meal or just a very thin layer, and by thin I mean probably a quarter of an inch of a good manure-based compost product.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I need to transplant several bedding plants that we planted that we're redoing. And I guess with the cold weather, do I want to wait now until spring, or can
tell me which plants specifically?
We have ginger. We have the yellow lantana flowering plant. There's a couple of others. I can't remember the names, but
okay.
Those are the main two.
Things that normally freeze back at least partially in the winter, like ginger and like lantana, I would wait until you see the buds swell and move it in early spring. Something that's an evergreen perennial, like Salvia greggii or the Mexican bush sage, those things do it today. I mean, those are perfect to transplant now. But if it's any of your tender salvias or lantana or things like that that would have the potential to freeze back if we got a, you know, brief period of colder weather, I'd want to wait till probably early to mid-March to transplant those.
Okay. And lastly, we had to remove several mountain laurels after 25 years. They just became too big.
Uh-huh.
And everybody said, oh, they're beautiful, you don't want to move them. But, you know, they were just too tall, too close to the house. And I hated to do it, but we took some out, and now we've replanted, and, you know, they're growing again. And I know people say don't do this, but I really just want to top those mountain laurels to keep them, you know, 3-4 feet high in certain areas.
Mm-hmm.
Any recommendations on how to do that and when to do that?
Well, prune them. Don't top them. Don't just go in and lop the top off of them, or you'll have an ugly plant. But go through and selectively prune out the limbs, the trunks that are getting too tall for you. You want to do this right after they bloom in the spring. Mountain laurels have already formed their buds. They formed their buds last fall. And if you prune too early, you're cheating yourself out of all those flowers that everybody's been admiring. So as soon as the flowers fade in the spring, that's the time to do any pruning you need to. It's much better to do it frequently and lightly. Frequently meaning probably every year or two. But you don't ever want to take away more than about a third of the foliage at any one time. So don't wait till they're overgrown before you start your pruning. But typically, mountain laurels are going to bloom February, March. Do your pruning immediately afterwards before the new growth starts.
Thank you, and I really appreciate it, and keep doing what you're doing. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, I enjoyed it as well, Vic, and I appreciate the call this morning. Thank you, sir.
Take care. All right.
You too. Bye. David, Bruno and David, hang on just a minute. I do need to get a break in here, and looks like I get to talk to you about Fanick's Nursery and Garden Center. Gosh, I've known the Fanick family. Well, certainly not since they started the nursery, because that was about 90 years ago, and I haven't been around that long, even close to it. But I've known three generations of the Fanicks pretty well, and they're true plantsmen. They're people that are in the business because they love plants and they love helping their customers. It's not just it's just not a box store mentality. Sell everything you can and move on. Fanick's is there to help you with fun things, and they've got a lot now. They've got their potatoes in. They've got a fresh shipment of onions have come in. They've got lots of wintertime vegetables, lots of wintertime flowers, and all kinds of fruit trees, all kinds of berry plants. Fanick's is just, well, again, with 10 acres of ground, you've got room to do a lot of different things. Roses will be coming in very shortly. Most of the fruit trees, actually, they've gotten away from bare root trees because they found they can get good container-grown trees for about the same price. So if you want to get a head start on your peaches and plums and things like that, go see Fanick's today. They're also well-stocked on those trees that qualify for the CPS Energy Green Tree Shade Rebate Program, where CPS will give you $50 credit for every tree you plant, up to a reasonable number of trees, as long as you plant them in the proper area to give some shade to your home. You have to go to CPS Energy's website to get all the details, but you can go to Fanick's to get the trees that qualify for that program. They also have fun stuff like the Ego Lithium Ion Battery powered outdoor equipment, Traeger pellet grills, and all the accessories. Get by and see Fanick's. They won't be closed, or they won't close again until probably Easter. They're only closed on major holidays, and easy to find over on Home Green Road, where they've been for all 90 of those years. You want to see what's going on in detail? We'll go to their website, Fanick, F-A-N-I-C-K, FanickNursery.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening on a beautiful Sunday morning out there. Get out and enjoy today. It's not going to be nearly as nice tomorrow if the weathermen are right for a change. But today, Lux, it looks like it's just going to be a great day to be outside. Wearing that jacket, of course. But looking at the phone, it looks like it's going to be Bruno and David and Chris. Let's start with Bruno. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yes, sir. Hi. We purchased a home here in November, and it came with a full-grown orange tree.
Okay.
And it was full of oranges, but we went to pick them, and they were very metallic taste.
Okay, were they sour or just kind of off-flavored?
Well, off-flavor, we're going with sour.
Okay. What probably happened, and congratulations on your new home, by the way, but the previous owners probably had a grafted orange tree. We got cold enough in 2021 to kill even the hardy oranges, the tangerines or satsumas, as we call them. Normally, they'll go down into the teens, but when we went down to single digits, the tops froze back on a lot of orange trees. The rootstock, which tends to have much bigger thorns and not very good fruit, came back out. And my suspicion is that what you probably have is a large, the rootstock most commonly used is called sour orange. And the oranges are slightly smaller, and you can make marmalade out of them. You can do some other things with them, but it's a fresh eating orange. they're going to pucker you up and leave a bad taste in your mouth. Now, a couple of things you can do if you don't want to just replace the tree, you could always regraft it. You can, find a friend or a neighbor that has a different variety, hopefully something a little bit hardier. And you can go back and graft. You could even make what we call a fruit cocktail tree out of it. You could graft a lemon on one branch and a lime on another branch and a tangerine on another branch and a grapefruit.
Okay.
Yeah, but as it is, there's no way that you can turn that sour rootstock back into a tasty orange. Like, say, develop a taste for marmalade or something like that.
Yeah,
you can
juice
them and add a bunch of sugar to the juice and enjoy them that way. But, it's not a matter of your culture. It's just that you really didn't have an orange tree. You had an orange rootstock in your new home.
Rootstock. Okay. Awesome. Okay. I mean, it was full of oranges, and we're like, God,
you were salivating, and then you bit into the first one and said, yuck.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Very good. Anything else I can help with?
No, that was it.
Well, as you develop that landscape around your new home, call me with any questions you have, Bruno. I appreciate the call. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you, sir. David's up next. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Bob. How you doing?
Off to a good start. It's a beautiful day out there.
Yes, sir, it is.
How can I help today? Yeah, go ahead.
I have a quick question. I live in the Lavernia area, southeast of San Antonio.
Right.
And in particular, sky pencil holly. What can you tell me about that?
Sky pencil holly is a nice upright holly, kind of patterned after Will Fleming was the original upright holly. We have found that sky pencil can sometimes be a booger to grow. You're in a good area for it. You've got good soil for it, and hopefully it'll do very well for you. In the hill country, it's just not been as good as some of the really upright hollies. But Lavernia area, you should do okay. It's evergreen. It's upright. It's going to top out probably 12, 15 feet tall for you. And just you're going to want to fertilize with some regularity, and you're going to want to give it some micronutrients. 2 years ago, I would have told you to put some green sand around it regularly. Today, there's a different natural product called azomite, A-Z-O-M-I-T-E. I kind of call it green sand on steroids. It's got so much more in it than just iron and zinc. And I'd be putting that on 2-3 times a year along with the good dry fertilizer. And your sky pencil wants good full sun, wants to be watered deeply whenever the soil is dry on the surface. And I think you've, in Lavernia, I think you'll find it to be a very satisfactory plant. If you told me stone oak, I'd be telling you about things I might replace it with.
And how far, I just want a hedge, but I don't want a solid hedge. Do you, how far apart would you plant those?
The plant at maturity is going to be maybe 2, 2.5, 3 feet wide. So if you want to see individual plants, I'd plant them 4 or 5 feet apart.
Okay. And what's the rate of growth on those?
Faster than an oak tree, slower than slower than some, you know, like xylosma or something like that. You're probably going to get somewhere between 8 and 15 inches of growth a year out of them.
Okay. Is there any other plant that you would recommend that grows in that, you know, thinner, taller?
There are several other good plants, but I can't really tell you anything much faster. Other things to look at, what we call Japanese yew, Podocarpus, is a good, very upright, very dark green foliage that'll grow 15, 20 feet tall if you don't prune it. Plenty cold hardy, and, you know, it once again is that very upright. What everybody does, they go off to Italy and they see Italian cypress, and they want that. And Italian cypress is a lousy plant here. But something like your sky pencil, there are a couple of other newer varieties of Yopon. There's the old-fashioned Will Fleming. These are all very upright plants. And if you want a tall hedge, those are probably going to be your best choice. Now, there are smaller plants that grow upright. You've got flowering plants, like what they call bridal veil, is a plant that blooms white in early spring, very upright grower, absolutely beautiful flowers. You can trim something like the Pride of Houston, Yopon holly, to be much more straight up, to be tree-like, if you like. We've got a big one planted years ago here at the nursery, and the top of it is dense, but, you know, it's a bare trunk. So if you're just looking to be able to see through, if you want a hedge but you don't want a solid screen, you could look at something like Pride of Houston Yopon, and beautiful red berries in the winter. Other things, there are some very upright roses. You're going to have to do some good soil preparation and watch your watering, but there are some roses they call pillar roses that will grow 6 or 8 feet tall that would certainly do what you're trying to do. I told you about the spirea or the bridal veil. There are a couple of varieties of abelia that are very upright. You don't want to need the dwarf or spreading forms, but I've got abelia around my 120-year-old home that's probably been there for 100 years. So it's another plant that you could look at. There are actually some very suitable varieties of bamboo. Let me check my time because I'm getting real close to the news time here. Matter of fact, I've got to go to news. Hang on a minute. This is KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening on a beautiful Sunday morning. I'm told that Chris is the only person on waiting to talk, so a couple of open lines. Grab on them if you like. 210-599-5555. David, I hope you're still listening. I'm sorry. I was concentrating so hard on coming up with varieties, I wasn't watching the clock closely enough. But there are some non-spreading bamboos, some of what we call clumping bamboos, like the Golden Goddess, several different ones actually out there that don't spread, that are quite attractive, that would give you the kind of look you like where you're looking for individual plants. Over that break, one of our managers here at the nursery, Wendy, was telling me about two new varieties of Yopon that look like they're going to be pretty good. Haven't had a lot of experiments with them, but there is one called Skyward, which is more of a pyramidal shape, and then another one called Skyline, which is going to be that columnar shape. So Skyward, Skyline, and do take a look at Alphonse Carr, take a look at Golden Goddess, some of the more columnar bamboos out there that don't spread so wide. Those are all good choices for you. And if you have any more questions, please just give me a call back. Right now, let's get back to the phone lines and talk to Chris. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Quick question for you about comfrey.
Okay.
Can you hear me good?
Yeah, we're loud and clearly.
Okay, awesome. So I'm wondering how to propagate comfrey. I've got one plant planted in the ground in my yard. And
uh-huh.
It's not the seeding kind. And I wanted to dig that up, and then I've seen videos on cutting like little 3-inch roots and, you know, be able to propagate that. Can you give me a rundown on that?
Yeah, comfrey does reproduce from root cutting, so to speak, and it's why I typically tell people with that type of comfrey, plant it somewhere you like, because it's always going to be there. You'll go back and try to dig it up 4 times, and it'll come back up again. I would wait until warm weather, unless you have a greenhouse. But then it's just a matter of, in effect, taking root divisions. Just take a little, probably 3-inch by 3-inch or a 3-inch round section of the root zone, potted up in reasonably good potting soil, and the great majority of them will form new plants.
So, Bob, can you plant, instead of going into a pot, can I go directly into the ground with those root cuttings?
I've had comfrey in the ground. I had a plant that was probably 10 years old that finally froze and died in 21 when we got down in the single digits up in Bernie. So it's a plant that can certainly stay outside. I suspect that, yes, you could go straight into the ground, but realize that probably not every root division is going to grow. The majority of them will. And if you want a sure thing, simply put them into some, you know, 4-inch or 6-inch pots until they resume growth, and then plant them out. If you have enough comfrey that if one or two of them decided they didn't want to grow, you could go dig another section and put in there, then I'd say it'd be fine. Once we get into warm weather, it'd be fine just to transplant, you know, a root division, so to speak. But I tend to want a sure thing. I would tend, and of course I'm fortunate enough I built a greenhouse a few years ago, but if it were mine, I probably would put them in 6-inch pots, stick them in the greenhouse until I saw some new growth coming out on them, and then plant them wherever.
Okay, now would you, can you lay those root cuttings on the side so you ensure that they're in the right orientation, if you will?
Orientation doesn't seem to matter. I think as best you can, I'd kind of try to have it oriented the way it was in the ground. It's called geotrophism, is what tells the top to grow up and tells the roots to grow down. But the comfrey's a pretty tough, hardy plant. Now, there's some new varieties out there that tend to flower more but don't seem to have quite that innate toughness in them. A lot of the newer varieties, flowering varieties, are white. The old one that I grew for so many years had more of a pink-purple flower to it. So there's more than one variety of comfrey, but I think you'd be successful with root divisions on any of them.
Okay, and then I was planning on planting them around kind of the drip line of my fruit trees. Is that a good idea, and how far apart should I do that, and do you recommend that?
Well, it just depends on how much comfrey you need. It's a moderately vigorous plant, and if you plan to go in the commercial comfrey business, I think that's fine. I would, I'd do it in such a way that you're not likely to trample it while you're, you know, doing your thinning on your fruit trees and things like that. But being out in full sun like that, getting regular watering and fertilizing that you're going to be giving your fruit trees, that the comfrey would love that just as well. And it does like full sun, and I think the medicinal values, if you were, the herbal oils and things that it produces, I think you get the best quality if it is in full sun. So nothing wrong with your plan as long as it's not going to get run over or trampled.
Okay, yeah, because I was mainly wanting to do it for kind of chop and drop, but also, you know, for medicinal purpose too, but to fertilize the trees also.
Oh, it's Yeah, it's a good perennial, and it does have a lot of uses. Now, I don't recommend, you will see things on the internet and other places that talk about making teas out of it, which I don't recommend. It has some things that I would not want to take internally in it, but it's great as a salve. It'll take care of everything from spider bites to wasp stings, scorpion stings. When you live an active life, as I think you and I probably do, you're gonna tangle with something unpleasant every now and then. And comfrey's really good to have. Howard Garrett talks about using it to take care of minor skin blemishes. My partner's former had a golden retriever, and I had a lab a few years ago, both of which had real severe skin issues, hot spots, and in the case of my lab, she had a problem. We didn't know Dr. Kirby then and never really got fully diagnosed, where she just, a big section of skin would just rot away every summer. And we would make, in effect, a tea. You don't boil the leaves, but you boil the water, then put some chopped up leaves in it, let it steep for a little while, and use that as a skin treatment. And let me tell you, it worked better than anything we've ever used on hot spots on dogs. So there are a lot of different uses for it. So it is a good thing to have growing around the garden.
When you do those root divisions, do you put them in, I know you like perlite for starting cuttings.
I'd just go into a potting soil that drains well.
Okay. All right. Well, awesome. Thank you so much.
Well, you're certainly welcome. I appreciate the call. Thank you, sir.
I have good
and time. You too, and I know we'll talk again. Looks like I've got Angie and Judy and Sherry waiting now. It's funny how we're going from all guys to all ladies. Angie, you're first in line. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Before I went out and sprayed my seaweed and molasses, I wanted to thank you a million times for the Quasar recommendation sprayer.
Isn't that neat? Those are the best sprayers I have ever found. Europeans just, I guess they've been gardening for a few hundred years longer than Americans have, and they really appreciate quality. But that Quasar sprayer is just in a class by itself. So I'm glad you're enjoying yours, and you've probably discovered that you can turn them upside down and they spray just as well as they do right side up.
And I just love how I'm not getting any stronger. I'm getting to be older, and just the twisting to getting the top off is so much easier.
Release. Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you like them as well as I do.
But yeah, and then you only have to pump a few times, and it just lasts forever coming out instead of pump, 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 pump. Trickle.
Isn't it fun when you find something that really works?
So I just wanted to make sure you knew that I'm very thankful for that recommendation. It really has changed my life for the better.
Well, I appreciate you letting me know. Is there anything else I can help you with today?
I think my only really quick question would be I still have my Turk's cap and my shrimp plant and my Esperanza. They're still green. They still got stuff on them. I just let them go, right? So I'm not going to cut them back at all.
It's up to you. The Turk's cap is, you know, it will eventually get, I guess mine's probably 4 feet tall, and I cut it back periodically. But if you want to just let it grow, it's you trim it only to shape it. Shrimp plant, same way. You're going to change the shape, but you're not going to make it bloom any better by trimming it back. Now, Esperanza, if we should get, you know, a really hard freeze down well in the 20s or something like that, the top may freeze back on it. And at that point, you may want to cut it back. Or you may just want to wait and see where it comes out in the spring. But really, on all those, I'm going to say it's totally up to you. It's totally optional. Things are dormant enough now that they are not likely to sprout back out immediately. So if you think they'll look better if you prune them, then it's going to be a beautiful day for pruning.
I noticed the birds like to perch in it, and I just like to give them somewhere to go. So, and the other one quick, on my asparagus patch, I have little wispy, little green. Do those need to be cut too if they're popping up? I'm getting my good ones, but I'm getting a lot of little wispy little tiny ones too.
Yeah, try to get them before they get wispy. Even if they're you know, just the size or thickness of a soda straw, they're still pretty darn tasty. So, you know, you can pick the big ones to share with your friends and family if you so choose, but the little ones ought to go, you know, straight into your mouth. But once they've started making that ferny growth, not going to be real good to eat, but you definitely do need to keep that pruned off. Otherwise, they'll slow down. Everything pruned off, because you don't want to slow down on the production of your big shoots.
Great. Thanks so much, Bob. Appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure, Angie. Thank you for the call this morning.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. All right, Judy and Sherry, hang on just a second. We've got to get a break in, and we'll be right back and talk more gardening.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to phone calls. Going to be Judy and then Sherry. Judy is first. Good morning, Judy.
Hey, good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I'm a continuation of the last caller. I have two little patches of asparagus, and I trimmed back one yesterday. There was mostly dead, but then there's a few long green ones. I haven't seen any new shoots coming up. Mm-hmm. So it's time. So I trimmed back one. So it's time. Is it time to do that, even though they're not completely frozen?
Absolutely. And trim back the green ones as well as the brown ones, because you want to encourage new growth. New growth is what you eat, and which is so good for you, too. So, yeah, cut everything in both patches back down to maybe an inch tall.
Okay. All right. I'll finish doing that then. Okay, I have another question on Turk's cap. So if I cut it back, what happens? I mean, if I cut it back to, say, 3-4 inches, and then we have a really hard frost.
If you cut it back like that, I would probably be prepared to cover it. If we do get real severe weather, I mean, it's native. It grows wild around my partner's ranch, you know, up in the hill country. So it is a tough, hardy plant. But, when you cut it back down like that, you're going, even though you can't see it, the plant's going to start preparing inside to put on a burst of growth in the spring. And that could potentially be damaged if we got really cold. So, if you want to cut it back now, by all means, do so. You won't have to water as often, but continue to care for it. But, yeah, if it's going to get much below freezing, I would probably plan on covering it. Do you have the traditional red Turk's cap?
I do. So the best thing to do is just leave it alone till we're through the frost.
Unless you're tired of looking kind of a raggedy look to it, which they all have. If you really like Turk's cap, there's a pink form that is at least as vigorous as the red and grows to about the same size. There's a white form I don't like as well because it doesn't, you know, it requires some deadheading to keep it looking nice. But if you love your red Turk's cap, look at the pink. And there is also something they call giant Turk's cap or tropical Turk's cap. Not going to recommend it as highly because it usually freezes to the ground every winter and it doesn't come into bloom until the fall. And where I live in the hill country, it usually freezes back just about the time it starts being really pretty. But if you have a protected area in your garden and you want a Turk's cap with a much larger flower, think about planting the tropical Turk's cap as well.
Okay. I don't have that much space to plant.
Well, then enjoy what you have and trim it back when you want to trim it back, but do prune it pretty severely so that you don't have to prune it again through the growing and flowering season, which is basically all spring and summer long.
So I'll just wait till another month or two to trim it back, so that's far, right?
That's what I'm going to do with mine.
Okay, I have another question. I have a Sunniso or a sage, and it gets too much shade from the fig tree, and so I need to move it.
Okay.
I think it's a dwarf one.
Uh-huh.
How do they move? Can I move it?
If you do it now, you should be. How long has it been in this spot where it is now?
Couple years.
Oh, yeah. It should be easy for you to move. It will not have developed a huge widespread root system. And if it is one of the better varieties, especially one of the more compact ones, yeah, I would have your new hole dug so it doesn't stay out of the ground. But if you feel energetic today, this would be a great day to get it done.
Okay.
And, just so you know, if anybody else out there is listening and has, you know, the older, uglier, taller type, I wouldn't recommend transplanting those because the new ones are so much more compact, so much prettier when they bloom. If you got one of the old, ugly ones, replace it with one of the, newer varieties, Eldorado, Desperado, Lowry's Legacy. There are a lot of good ones out there, but anybody that has, you know, a really good one like Judy, if you need to move it, now is certainly the time of year to do it.
Okay. All right. That sounds like a good plan. Thank you very much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. I appreciate the call this morning. All right. Next in line is Sherry. Good morning, Sherry.
Hi, Bob. I was calling. I have a little flower bed by my front door. It only gets a probably a couple hours of sunlight because I have a big tree.
Okay. Morning or afternoon? Morning, afternoon sun when it does get sun?
Like 11 to 1.
Okay. So middle of the day, pretty hot sun. Uh-huh.
Well, I'm wondering what I can put out there now for flowering.
Pansies, Johnny Jump Ups, those are going to continue to bloom throughout the winter months. If they get 2 hours of good strong sun, they'll get a little leggy ultimately, but you could plant those. You can plant dianthus and snapdragons. Now, they will continue to bloom until we have a really hard freeze, and then they'll slow down on their blooming, but they'll continue to grow, and then they will be absolutely spectacular in the spring. And those would also be good choices. If you want more flowers, and with that much sun, they're not going to last quite as long into the spring, but cyclamen would be beautiful out there, and you know, with the cooler weather, a couple hours of midday sun are not going to bother them at all. When we get to May and we're starting to get up into the 90s, yeah, they're probably going to give up a little bit quicker than the ones in the shade will, but cyclamen would be a pretty thing to plant out there for flowers. And this has been one of the prettiest years I have ever seen for ornamental kale and ornamental cabbage. And the cool weather, especially the pink and purple varieties, are just spectacular. And they're going to be pretty throughout the winter months. And if you have room, you mentioned it's a fairly small area, but gosh, just use your imagination. Put a big purple cabbage in the middle and some bright yellow pansies around it, or put a bright purple cabbage there and, you know, some pink cyclamen or something like that. You could do a real pretty combination bed in there with some colorful foliage as well as the flowers.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
You are certainly welcome. And I certainly do appreciate the call. Let's go ahead and get a break in here, Don, and we'll be back and take some more phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening, and looks like we're going to talk with Rosa and then Tenny. Rosa's first in line. Good morning, Rosa. Hi, Rosa. Need to be listening to your telephone, not your radio, because we are mandated to be on a time delay. Rosa, good morning. How are you today?
Doing great.
Good.
I wanted to ask you about my grape vine. I have never pruned it. Do the grapes come out on the old vines, or should I cut it and have new vines?
The grapes will come out on the old vines. What you do to get maximum production from your grapes is you don't go, you know, cut the whole plant back, but you want to thin it out. Grapes, as you well know, tend to make a lot of foliage, and each year about this time, we go through and we leave a few of the vines intact just as they're growing, but we thin out up to 70-80% of the, you know, viney material there in order to get the ones that are left behind making nice bunches of grapes and not just two or three little grapes here and there. So thin them out, but don't overall cut the whole plant back. Does that make sense?
Yes, it sure does. Now, if I can just see what I'm doing when I get out there.
Well, that's the nice thing. This time of year, the grapes tend to lose at least a lot of their leaves, so it's a little bit easier to do, but you can be, you know, pretty brutal with them. They're a tough plant, and you sometimes have to get in there and pull them apart a little bit to see what you're doing.
Okay. Thank you so very much. Have a great day.
Yeah, and you do the same, Rosa. Thank you. All right, it's Tenny's turn. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How about you today?
Oh, I'm enjoying this beautiful weather.
This year's off to a good start. If it'll just keep up like this through the rest of January and February, I think we'll have a lot of happy gardeners out there.
I know. I'm excited. So I have a few questions for you.
Okay.
So my bat-based cubia, some of it is still alive, some of it's dead. It's in a planter. Can I cut off the dead and can I just leave it outside, or do I need to bring it inside when the temperature gets to a certain low?
If we get down to the point of frost or colder, the part of your bat face that is exposed is probably going to freeze. That's not at all unusual. A mild winter bat face cuffia, well, most of your cuffias tend to come back out in the spring. A really cold winter, it just acts like an annual. It just dies and you have to replace it. So it will look a lot nicer if you cut off the portion that's died. But when you do that, you're going to expose the tender stuff that's underneath it. So if you're going to trim off the dead, be prepared to cover it. And we're looking at maybe some frosty weather throughout the rest of this week. So it'll look a lot nicer if you trim it. But if you do that, you're probably going to have to cover it on nights when we might get a heavy frost.
So just don't mess with it and maybe bring it in on those nights?
It would be a good idea. It would be okay. A good idea. It, you know, some of the cuffias are very distinctly perennial. The David Verity, the one they call cigar plant. A lot of those you just don't have to worry about. If they freeze down, they come back out. Other cuffias like Mexican heather and like the bat face, if it gets really cold, they die and have to be replaced. So it's a good idea to do what you've done. Keep it in a pot where you can bring it in when it's going to get very much below freezing.
Okay. And also on the, I heard you talk to somebody, I think maybe a couple of weeks ago or something, about the purple trailing lantana.
Right.
Once again, it's in a planter and it's mm-hmm. still outside. Some of the leaves are turning purple. Some are still green. Is it okay to leave outside, or do I need to do the same with it?
It's fine down into the middle 20s. It may get a little nipped, but this is a time of year that your trailing lantanas, both the purple and the white, tend to put on their best flowers. And lantanas are interesting things. The really bright colors, the yellows and reds and hot pinks, they are bush-type lantanas. They bloom in the warm months. They typically freeze all the way to the ground in the winter. The trailing ones, like your beautiful purple one, they bloom some during the warm months, but boy, spring and fall, chilly weather, this is when they are just absolutely spectacular. Having the leaves get a little bit of purple in them is totally normal. It's just because the production of the green pigment, the chlorophyll, slows down, and this allows all those areas that have, it's called anthocyanin, and it's the purple pigment, and it's why blues are deeper blue, purples are deeper purples, and on many plants, the leaves, which are typically a bright green, tend to start having more of a purplish cast. That's just the nature of the plants. That's perfectly normal.
Okay. And I wish I knew what this is called. I'm going to try to describe it the best that I can, but it's almost like a little tree with a very couple of skinny stalks, and it blooms has a real nice soft green foliage, and then it blooms like this little string that comes out with these little tiny purple flowers that just kind of dangle. It looks great, and it's in a pot, and it's doing really pretty. It's obviously not blooming right now, but do you know what that would be? Did I describe it good enough? The flowers are little tiny. They're like these little strings that grow out, and they hang down and then they get these beautiful little tiny, tiny purple, almost blue-looking flowers. They might have a little white on
it
them.
Probably is something we call Giranta or Brazilian sky flower. And the butterflies love them. The hummingbirds like the purple one. There's a white form. There's a purple form. There's some forms that have variegated foliage, but not much in the way of flowers. But I believe what you're describing, if you want to look it up botanically, it's called Giranta, D-U-R-A-N-T-A. The common name is Brazilian sky flower. If you don't prune them and if they don't freeze, they will grow 5 or 6 feet tall in a growing season. They make quite large plants, but pretty flowers. And like I say, the butterflies love them and the hummingbirds to a certain extent. If the weather gets much below freezing, the tops will freeze to some extent. A really cold winter, they freeze down to the ground, but if they're mulched, they come back out. But I think you're describing the Brazilian sky flower.
I want to say that kind of sounds familiar, but I forgot, and it's been so long because I bought it on clearance, so it didn't have a tag.
You name it whatever you like, but, you know, you hear me talk all the time about the importance of keeping notes about gardening. It brings up a good thought. It's fun to keep a little map, to keep a little diagram of things you plant, because those tags, well, they might not be right to begin with, but they do tend to get lost. They do tend to get confused. And sometimes you just want to look back and see what it is, sometimes because you want to say, I'm never going to plant that again. And sometimes you say, well, I want to plant more of that. It's hard to know what you have out there. So do look it up, you know, look online or whatever. And if it's Brazilian sky flower, it's a good plant. There are some of them that are a little bit more spreading than so upright. Some of them can actually be grown in a hanging basket, but it's a good perennial. There's nothing at all wrong with it. Some of the varieties that have the variegated foliage come well armed. They have some pretty big thorns on there that you don't want to, you know, come in contact with unexpectedly. But overall, it's something that I'll put on a pretty desirable list of plants.
Okay, yeah, it is. It's so beautiful and delicate. And I want to tell you, right up the street from us, we live out in the country, and right up about a mile, barely a mile up the road, there is a huge bee area. And I feel so blessed because for some reason, my lemon tree is blooming again. And
oh, yeah.
All the flowers around here, and the bees are everywhere.
Well, that means lots of lemons, I hope.
I hope so, because I only got three last year.
Yeah, and that's a good thing. And be aware that that's a very bad pun that I didn't really intend. But there are a lot of, we do have a lot of the so-called Africanized bees in this area. Mm-hmm. And they look exactly like the honeybees, European honeybees. They act exactly like the European honeybees unless you disturb the hive. When they're out foraging in your garden, when they're out pollinating your flowers, you would never know one from the other. But if you're up the street and, you know, just be careful, because they can be deadly. Animals and people both die every year from bee stings, and they can be very, very aggressive. Don't be trying to harvest the honey yourself. But
I'm not going to touch it. That's somebody else's property. So.
Okay, well, you never know whether, because like I say, they behave the same when they're away from home, but you don't want to be the one that disturbs the hive, because it... it can be painful at best and potentially lethal at worst. So enjoy them in your garden, but don't go looking for their colony.
Nope. I have nothing to do with them. They do their job and they leave them.
That's the way it ought to be.
Yes. I appreciate you and for all your knowledge, and you have a wonderful day.
And you do the same, and a happy new year as well. I look forward to talking with you again. You're welcome.
Thank you.
All right, let's see here. Don's telling me we've got Robin and Robert. I think we've got time to take one more call before we take a break. So let's talk to Robin. Good morning, Robin.
Good morning, Bob.
Thank you for calling.
I've got a real quick question here. I want to plant a finiso. Is that how you say it?
Are you talking about the one they call purple sage?
Yes.
It's actually usually called ceniza with an A, Spanish word for ashes, because the original form, always had the gray leaves. Cenizo is a totally different plant, and cenicio is still a different plant. So if you're going to call it by its common name, call it ceniza.
Okay. And which variety would you recommend?
My favorite varieties, there's an orchid purple one that's just called Compact Texas Sage that's absolutely beautiful. There's one that's a little darker purple that's called Desperado. There's a pure white one. I want to say it's Snow Cloud or something like that. Those are all compact and very, very attractive ones that they stay down to about 4 feet, 4 to 5 feet in height, but those are all pretty. There is one that's a little bit bigger, not quite as compact, that has a lavender flower that was selected, developed by a fellow named Lynn Lowry, and who passed away a few years ago, and that one's called Lynn's Legacy. And it's another pretty one, but if you're looking for the really dark colors, probably Desperado, or just your good old compact Texas sage. Those are going to be the prettiest ones for you.
Okay, thank you. And you had talked about cornmeal portonial fungus the other day.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How do you prepare that? What is the formula?
You want to use not baking cornmeal, but what's called whole ground or stone ground cornmeal. And the cornmeal isn't the magic. The cornmeal grows a fungus, not a very pretty fungus, but it grows a fungus called trichoderma. And the trichoderma is what controls your toenail fungus and other problems. So I, like everybody else, I get a little touch of it every now and then, but I go to the grocery store and I get loaf pans. My foot fits just about right in one of those aluminum foil pans. And you just want to put an inch or two of cornmeal in there, moisten it to where it makes kind of a slurry. You don't want it to be really liquid, but you want it to be good and moist. And then you just soak your foot in it for about an hour a day. I will tend to put it in the refrigerator between use, and after 3 or 4 days, you'll definitely want to make some fresh. But do that about every day for a week, and then skip a week, and then do it again every day for a week. And it tends to eliminate the toenail fungus. It takes a little while for the nail bed to grow back out. But it's funny, somebody will come into the nursery and they'll kind of want to get you off to the side and say, tell me about this cornmeal for the toenail fungus. And it turns out to be some of the doctors that don't want to take their own medication, which can mess up your liver and things. But my niece, who's a doctor in Mexico, tells me they've been doing it down there for 100 years and it really does work.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. You're just a fountain of knowledge. I love it.
I have made just about every mistake you can make in the world of gardening. I'm a research biologist by training. So if I can just keep you from making all the mistakes that I have, you'll be a long way ahead. So I appreciate the call, and you get out and have a happy new year.
Thank you, Bob.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. Robert, hang on just a second. Need to get a break in here, and then we'll have quite a while to talk with you. Be right back.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right. Back to gardening. It's going to be Robert, Cynthia, and Carl. Robert is first in line. Good morning, Robert.
I'm building a raised bed for a potato bed.
Very good.
I have an old hay ring, the top of it. I was going to wrap the outside with wire.
Okay.
But I put hay, like old hay that's been in the bottom of the hay ring for the cows, in there as a base? Or would it get too hot?
Well, I'm not so worried about the heat as I am with what might be on the hay. Is this hay you grew yourself, or is this hay that you purchased?
No, it's hay I purchased.
Okay. Probably the majority of the hay that's sold these days has been sprayed with a very toxic chemical called picloram that doesn't go away. And it doesn't hurt grasses. That's why they go out and spray it on their coastal fields and things like that. But it will kill everything else that you plant. So what you would want to do is take a sample of this hay, or maybe more than one, soak it in a bucket of water overnight, and then take that water and, you know, find a dandelion or a henbit or some clover or something like that, some tender vegetation. Pour the water over it and watch it for a couple of days. If the weed continues to grow, then you'll know that your hay is clean. And as long as you mix probably four or five parts of soil to one part old hay, you'd be okay to, you know, use that in your bed. But if the weed starts looking burned on the edges or looks bad, you need to get rid of that old hay and, you know, not. You can put it around grass and things like that, because, like I say, the picloram doesn't hurt grass, but it'll kill tomatoes, it'll kill flowers, it'll kill potatoes. You don't want to have anything to do with that around plants you want to protect.
Okay, thank you.
You're certainly welcome. And other than that, that ring would make a perfect raised bed, as it were. I think you might want to spray it with some sort of sealant, some sort of epoxy paint, because once you get wet soil against it, it's probably already rusty to begin with, and putting wet soil against it, it's going to rust out faster than you want it to. So spray it with some epoxy paint or paint it on or something like that, and it'll give you a good raised bed for years to come.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure, Robert. Thanks for the call this morning. Cynthia's next. Good morning, Cynthia.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have created the perfect tree. I just need to know if it exists.
You've created it mentally. Now we need to see if Mother Nature's done the same. Tell me exactly what your perfect tree would be.
Okay, would be multi-legged like a crepe myrtle.
Okay.
About 12, 15 feet tall with a nice canopy to shade over patio area that would be evergreen.
Okay.
I should have said multi-trunked.
Yeah, multi-trunk. There are some potential things. The problem is that it's going to have to be pretty widespread to really give very much shade. It can't be purely upright. If you want to see something pretty, what do you live here in San Antonio?
Yes.
Right by our nursery, Shades of Green, sometime, and look, we have a Pride of Houston Yaupon holly that pretty much meets your description. This one's been in several years. We trimmed it to be a tree. If you didn't trim it, it would just be a shrub, but we couldn't give up that much space underneath it. So it is multi-trunked. It has a nice evergreen top, has beautiful red berries on it this time of the year, and it is about as close to a, you know, multi-trunk tree-like plant as you're going to find. Another plant that comes to mind is bay laurel, Laurelus nobilis, which is the same bay that you spend a lot of money for in HEB, used to make gumbo and things like that. Other things that could be trimmed to be that shape, it'd be slow growing, but up to a point you could actually do that with a mountain laurel. They tend to be multi-trunked and evergreen. Again, it's gonna be hard to find something that spreads out like an umbrella. Now, if you want a lower quality tree, what we call there's an old fashioned one people call China berry or Chinese umbrella tree. There's a compact form.
I just got rid of all of those. No.
Okay. Well,
they are pretty, but oh my God, what a mess.
And the other one that kind of fits that category but is a bit messy would be a mulberry. Drops a lot of fruit, and the birds tend to love the fruit. So where the birds are, you tend to deal with a lot of droppings from the birds, so to speak. But, a mulberry is another tree that you could trim in that fashion. go right by the Botanical Center sometime. Go walk through, and you'll see a lot of different plants, you know, growing in, you know, in different fashions. We also have planted at the nursery here, we have a gorgeous plant that's called the Hong Kong Orchid Tree. It's actually in bloom right now. And, I mean, it'll grow 10 feet tall in 1 year, and you can trim it to be the shape that you like. But when you have a cold winter, it's going to freeze way back. A couple of years ago, ours froze. We had wrapped the trunk because the tree had gotten to be 15 feet tall and 25 feet wide, and there's no way we could cover that. But we wrapped the trunk. It froze down to about 4 feet tall, and within a year, you know, it's back being a huge plant once again. So the Hong Kong orchid tree is a possibility, but just recognize that if we have a real cold winter, it's going to freeze back. But in the meantime, beautiful flowers, big old leaves on it, interesting plant, and can be trimmed and shaped the way you'd like, and very, very fast growing. So those are all possibilities that come quickly to mind.
Okay, what was the first one you mentioned? The Pride of
the Yopon, Pride of Houston Yopon Holly.
Okay, I might look at that one. And how readily available is the Hong Kong orchid?
Not.
Not.
there's only one company. It's a patented plant, and there's only one nursery in the country that grows it, which is Monrovia out of California. Every year we order about 100 of them, and they ship us about 10. And so the demand usually exceeds the supply. But just start checking with your nurseries about the end of February. That's about the time Monrovia is going to start shipping things out to our part of the country. And look around. And like I say, I know we've ordered a bunch of them this year. I imagine Fanix has. What Monrovia decides to ship us is just kind of wait and see. So, and like I say, those California nurseries tend to start shipping in sometime in late February, early March, and that'd be the time I'd check back with your nurseries and find out if anybody's gotten any of them in stock.
Okay. Well, I'll look into those. Thank you so much.
You are certainly welcome. I certainly appreciate the call this morning. And I tell you what, we are getting real close to news time, so rather than rush anybody else, let's wait a couple of seconds till the news break is over, and then we'll talk a little bit more with callers. Right now, I will remind you, great time to be planting pansies, snapdragons, dianthus out in sunny spots. Great time to be planting cyclamen in the shade. Great time to be planting colorful foliages like ornamental kale and cabbage, which will grow in shade or sun. Just don't have a drab yard. There are also a few perennials, especially a few of your salvias, like Salvia greggii, that continue to bloom through the winter months that you could certainly be planting. And your hardier things, great time to get that perennial bed going. If you have a yard that has suffered from the severe drought and severe heat last summer, this would be an ideal time to put a thin layer of put some fertilizer on, and then put a thin layer of compost on. Cooler weather makes it a whole lot easier to do that work, because it is some work to do. But I don't know anything that will bring back a yard that was damaged from heat and drought the way that compost will. Just get a good manure-based compost. Stay away from the biosolids compost, but a good manure-based compost, and put it down between a quarter and half an inch deep. And I know not a single thing that will do more to get your yard back in good shape for the summer months. Lots more to talk about, and lots more phone calls to talk to, which we will do right after news. You're listening to Gardening here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
And we do have several lines open right now, so if you've been getting a busy signal, be a real good time to dial. I guess a few folks have headed off to church, but we do have, I think, three lines open, so you know the number, 210-599-5555. Janie is waiting right now to talk. Good morning, Janie.
Good morning, Bob. It's Janie calling.
It's always good to hear your voice, Janie. How can I help you today?
Well, my son picked up that weed puller, okay?
Okay.
And I tried it, and I had a little problem pulling it back and forth because my dirt is regular dirt. Is your sand or what? out there where you live?
The softer the dirt, the deeper you can dig. But even on hard soil, all you really have to do on most of those weeds is just cut it off right at ground level. So the nice thing about it, you don't have to bend over. It's not hard on your back. It definitely will give your shoulders a little bit of a workout, but it's the best thing going. But don't feel like you have to press it way down into the ground. Most of those weeds, if you cut them off right at the surface of the ground, they will not come back.
Okay. Let me ask you something else. To sharpen it. Okay. I know I clean it real good. I got a knife out there.
Uh-huh.
And I scrape it with that. And I've been using sandpaper. I don't know if you ever heard of that, that people sharpen their tools with that.
You can do that, but I will tell you, if he got you a good quality push-pull hoe or stirrup hoe, I've got one that I haven't sharpened in 6 or 8 years. I've had to put 3 new handles on it because everything from, somebody chewing on it to a cow stepping on it one time have broken the wooden handles. But if you've gotten a good one with good quality steel, you'll probably never have to sharpen it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I did clean it because I know there was dirt, so I...
Oh, yeah. The cleaning is always good, and... I guess you could sharpen it. What you always have to be careful of is don't do anything that creates a lot of heat, because really good quality sharp edges are done with what we call tempered steel. And if you heat them up, like putting them on a grindstone, like you sometimes do on with an iron knife or things like that, you can ruin the temper. You can actually make your tool's much more susceptible to getting dull. So I don't think sandpaper would hurt anything, but I don't think you're going to have to use it.
Okay. Do you use oil to clean it afterwards?
Sure. Absolutely. It's, lubricate those, that little, oh, I don't know what you'd call that joint where it moves back and forth, but you sound like a lady that takes care of your tools. Treat it just like you would a good pair of pruning shears, and don't loan it to anybody, and you'll enjoy it for a lot of years to come, Janie.
Well, okay, then I'm going to wait for the doctor to come out because I need to call him.
He'll be here in about 50 minutes or so, and we'll look forward to hearing back from you again.
Okay, thank you very much.
You are certainly welcome. You are certainly welcome. Okay, looks like we've got E.T., Paul, and Norma waiting. E.T.'s next in line. Good morning.
Morning, Bob. How are you today?
I'm off to a good start. It's a beautiful day out there, a little bit chilly, but let's just say for January, it's pretty darn nice.
Okay, great. I got a question about ornamental pepper plant. It's growing in a container. Mm-hmm. How long is its life expectancy?
About 3 years if you don't let it freeze. In nature, they are a perennial, but they grow, down into Central and Northern South America, Southern Mexico. So if you can keep it from freezing, it'll continue to grow and produce for 3 to 4 years. Now, the older it gets, the woodier it gets, it won't produce as much fruit as it does when it's a young, vigorous plant, but that fruit will still taste great. So, yeah, if you've and if you're just growing it as an ornamental pepper, just enjoying the colorful peppers, it'll still be beautiful for you. So you keep it from freezing, and you'll have it for 3 or 4 years.
Can I trim it?
You can. I would trim it in early spring, early to mid-spring, probably late February or March, and never cut off more than about a third of the leaves at any one time.
Okay, and other perennials, how often should I water them in the winter and perennials in containers?
You should, in both cases, you should feel the soil. When it's good and dry on the surface, it's time to water again.
Okay.
How often that is, I'll get back to the perennials for just a second. The sunnier it is, the faster they will dry out. So, and the windier it is, the faster they'll dry out. So don't try to do it by the calendar. Don't say I'm going to do it every 5 days or every 2 weeks. Just get out there and feel the soil. And when it feels good and dry on the surface, give them a good drink.
Okay, and garlic, from the time I plant one to it sprouts, how long till harvest?
We typically allow garlic to grow until the tops start to fall over, which is typically in early summer. Depending on how early you plant it will make a big difference in how big the pot of garlic it produces. But normally, with both the soft neck and the hard neck garlics, usually when the top starts to fall over, that's when we harvest. And, at least in my garden, that's usually in June.
Okay. Cause I planted about 8 weeks ago. I started about 8 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by late spring, early summer, you should have some real good garlic.
Okay, and lately we have all this scare about listeria, you know, and cantaloupes and lettuce. Best way to dispose of it, can I chunk it over the fence if I had something like that, or stick it in a compost pile, or
No. No, put it in the compost pile will be just fine. And if you want to protect yourself, hydrogen peroxide is something you can rinse your vegetables with. They also make something you get at the grocery store. I believe it's just called fruit wash, that will take off, you know, any kind of bacterial contamination or things like that. But just good old hydrogen peroxide will do the same thing if you have any concerns. You don't really want to soak it, but if you rinse quickly with it, it's a great way to clean things up.
Okay, great. And I got last strange questions about cats and dogs. Does a well-fed barn cat or feral cat, a well-fed barn or feral cat catch more rodents than one that's half-starved?
Probably not necessarily. Cats are, whether they're feral or not, they're creatures that love to play. And I have seen cats, both, you know, tame cats and feral cats, I've seen them literally play a rodent to death. And they seem very disappointed when the thing finally dies. And they sit there with their paw and they'll hook it and throw it up on the air and jump on it. So a cat can be predatory even if it's not hungry. Now, a hungry cat probably is going to eliminate more mice and rats, but... you know, a healthy, active cat is still gonna, even if it's not killing them to eat, it's gonna play them to death periodically. So, I don't know that you see a whole lot of difference. A young cat will very definitely take out more than a really, really old cat will, but, they always seem to want to supplement their diet. They always seem to want to, you know, play as much as possible. So they're good creatures to have around, whether they're barn cats or house cats.
Okay, and the last question about dogs. Do they have a sense of humor? Do they laugh?
I have always heard it said that dogs laugh with their tails. That when a dog is really happy, you know, you will know it. In fact, somebody sent me a diagram of how the tail is attached to the heart or something like that. Whether they have a sense of humor or not, I'm not sure, but I'll tell you, there is very definitely a difference in the intelligence levels. Some of them can be very conniving. I have seen dogs do, you know, various humorous things to try to get a toy away from another dog. So they do love to play, and they do enjoy it a great deal. I don't know whether you'd say they have a sense of humor or not, but they sure make me laugh sometimes.
Okay, Bob, thank you very much, and you have a fantastic New Year.
You do the same, E.T. Always good to talk to you. Thank you, sir. All right, yeah, looks like we better get a quick break in here, and we'll be right back with more phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, my next three callers are Paul, Norma, and Tony. Paul's first. Good morning, Paul.
Morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have a question about trees.
Okay.
So I have a place in Burney, probably close to where yours is, but in the drought and in the freeze, we lost a lot of mature trees.
Okay.
But the problem is I'm not seeing any young trees.
Yeah. You're seeing a lot of deer. You're seeing a lot of creatures out there, and it is a big problem. And I'll tell you, one of the things that I did on my ranch, at the suggestion of a friend that was with Parks and Wildlife at the time, I actually cleared several acres of a hilltop and used the cedar that I was cutting to basically build a barricade around that the deer couldn't get through, that my cattle couldn't get through. And now I've got young trees coming up in those protected areas. But the problem is that, you know, we're way, way, way overpopulated with deer. One biologist told me that the healthy carrying capacity of the hill country was about 800,000 deer, and we currently have about 12 million. So you're either going to have to plant new trees and protect them, or you're going to have to find a way to keep the deer and other browsing creatures, and that's both whitetails and axis, but you're going to have to find a way to keep them out so that the new trees can get established and grow. We're just way overpopulated with things that like to eat trees.
Well, I just, on this 200 acres, I just eradicated all of the cedar.
Yeah.
And so I have some cleared areas where I can do such a thing, but how do you keep the deer out of them?
Well, and that's the problem. Again, I just piled the cedar about 5 feet high and kind of built myself a little gate so I could get in and out, but I'm sure you probably either chipped your cedar or burned your cedar. So, there are ways to keep deer out without building a big expensive fence. I would talk to Parks and Wildlife. You probably want their non-game division, but they have come up with it's an electric fence solution. It's like a three-wire solution where the three wires are offset. And I haven't tried it yet, but they tell me it's doing a good job of keeping the deer out. Electric fence is a lot easier than it used to be. In fact, in a lot of cases, you don't use a stiff wire anymore. You use a braided, kind of like a nylon rope that has little, very fine copper wires through it. It's much easier to put up and, seems to do a pretty good job, but I'll refer you to Parks and Wildlife as to the best way to do it. I know they've been doing some experimenting too down the way from my ranch is on 46, and I'm just a few miles from the ABK State Natural Area, a little bit further west of me, and I know that the guys down there have been doing some different experiments with hog control and things, but Parks and Wildlife probably is going to be able to tell you the best way to screen the deer out. Now, if you've recently won the lottery, you want to build a nice 6.5 foot high fence all the way around it, like they're doing over around the rich people's place in Cordillera. They're building quite a fence over there, but it's a little bit beyond my budget. I'll just put it that way. But
mine also. So, mature must a tree be in order for it to survive? In other words, if I were to grow from acorns, how tall or how big a tree could I put in the ground and expect to live without
deer? You know, if a whitetail stands up on its hind feet, which it will do to try to eat the foliage, you're probably looking at eating, well, if you look at your trees that you have, you can probably see what we call a browse line, which is basically how high they can reach, and that's usually 6 to 7 feet off the ground.
That's a pretty mature tree.
Yeah, it's a pretty mature tree, especially if your soil is as thin as mine. The other problem, and it's more true of whitetails than axis, but probably some degree with the axis, is in the rutting season, you know, late summer on through early winter, the bucks are out there to mark their territories and also to rub the velvet off their antlers. And there's many a tree that's bigger than that that, they rub the bark off and kill the trees that way. So until that tree gets a rough bark on it, which is going to be more like a 6 or 8 inch caliber tree, the deer can do, can actually kill trees that way. What I do where I've planted new trees in, parts of my yard, I have part of my yard that's deer-proof, part of it that isn't. But in midsummer, I will take just the old common metal T-post, and depending on how big around the tree is, I'll use from, you know, 3 to 5 T-posts. I just put them up against the trunk, put a piece of baling wire around the top, piece of baling wire around the bottom, and the deer don't want to rub their antlers on that. But it's best thing we could do would be to eliminate about 90% of the deer in the hill country, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. It's kind of like the hogs are such an issue, and they found a bait that is safe for cattle, safe for deer, doesn't really kill anything except hogs, but it does kill a few raccoons and things. And I personally, that makes me like it even better, because I've got a lot more raccoons than I wish I had, and they can be real trouble causers too. But, you know, I know that better scientists than I have been looking at things that might potentially reproduce or reduce the reproductive rate, could increase the sterility in deer so they're not having as many fawns, but nobody's come up with a good solution yet. And since we've eliminated the mountain lions and things, and screwworm used to be the biggest predator on whitetails, we just have a huge overpopulation. And as long as we have that, unless we can find a way to keep the deer out, it will be an ongoing problem. And like I say, the first exclosure, which is what my biologist friend told me, he called it, Rufus Stevens is his name. And actually, if you want a consultant, he does, for a reasonable price, he does consulting about many different things related to wildlife. But the first one I did was very small, probably no more than 40 feet in diameter, and I had trees start coming up in the middle of it. The biggest one I've done was several acres, and I've got, you know, thick small trees like some of the different lower growing oaks, and now I've got lots of other things coming up in the middle of those. They're literally so thick that the deer and the cattle can't get into them. So it's nothing that's going to happen overnight, but
how long did it take you to get that to that position, to where you had that kind of growth? How many years?
About 3 years.
Yeah. Well, those are certainly some things to talk about. Right now, and I just captured a ringtail cat in my attic.
Nice thing about it, you can pretty much trap them with raw meat. And they're vicious, you know. Be very careful with ringtails. They or civet cats, as they're called. They're pretty obnoxious little creatures. But I will tell you one thing. Back in when I had more time to spend creating my exclosures, I was probably in the best physical shape I've been in since college. So it's there's some good side effects to doing things like that.
Yeah, there's always something to do when you're out in the country.
Absolutely. And if you've got a couple of 100 acres, you certainly don't have to join any fitness clubs, that's for sure.
No, you certainly don't.
Well, Paul, talk to Parks and Wildlife, and he probably has a website. Google Rufus Stevens sometime. Rufus is just incredibly good guy, and he was actually district leader. He originally was had about a 5-county district, and then he was looking after about 40 counties in our part of Texas. And when he retired from Parks and Wildlife, he's been doing consulting since that time, and he's very low-key. He's one smart guy who'll tell it like it is, and I think you would really enjoy knowing him.
Well, thank you for that, Bob, and I will look him up and give him a call.
Sounds great. Appreciate the call, Paul. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Goodbye. All right, let's go ahead and talk to Norma, and then we'll talk to Tony. Good morning, Norma.
Good morning, Bob. Thank
Good
you for
morning.
My call.
Thank you for calling.
Yes, sir. I have a couple of questions. First of all, my main concern right now is I just moved from San Antonio to Kyle, and I planted in a new yard. I mean, not a new yard, but a yard that we cleaned up, and planted two of them. One was doing really well. The other one was like stunted, but it kept on going. And now I noticed that both of them have brown edges on all their leaves, and new growth is dying.
And tell me once again what kind of plant we're talking about.
Pride of Barbados.
Oh, Pride of Barbados. Pride of Barbados is not cold hardy. And Kyle, you're further north in San Antonio, and most years it's going to freeze all the way to the ground in the winter. Mine certainly does in Bernie. It has always come back. It is one of the toughest plants around, but, you're just looking at weather. I don't think you've got any problems going on.
I hope not. Great. I'm just curious if, something, a bug or whatever, but it's happening to both of them.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a second question. I have some seedlings for a trumpet vine of mm-hmm. my mother's, and I want to know how long can I leave it outside, because they're growing, maybe 2.5 inches.
Mm-hmm.
Do I plant them now, or do I save them until the spring?
Save them until we're past the danger of freezing weather. Now, be certain that you really want to plant trumpet vine, because once you plant it, you'll never be rid of it. It will come up all over your yard. It will put out an underground runner that goes 15, 20 feet away from the main plant and then sprouts and comes up. I literally know people who have moved to get away from their trumpet vine.
Really?
Because it's worse than bamboo as far as being invasive.
My mother didn't have this problem. I did have one in San Antonio, and it came up a little further away, and I just nipped it.
Well, but it will become. It may be. Some of them may be more invasive. The one called Madam Galen is one of the ones that's probably one of the better ones to plant. When you plant it from a seed, you never know what you're going to get. But if you were to go out and buy one, I probably would suggest Madam Galen, because it is not quite as invasive. But I tell you, the only place I would ever plant one would be like, an open spot where you've got concrete all the way around it, like a patio or something with a planter in the middle of it, or a circular driveway or something like that, because it can become a problem. I'll just tell you a word to the wise on that one. There's some other pretty things out there that are not quite so invasive. I would look, if you like trumpet vine, I would look at something called Tangerine Beauty Crossvine. Technically it's called Bignonia, but take a look at Tangerine Beauty Crossvine. It has a similar, absolutely beautiful orange flower on it, but it is not nearly as invasive as trumpet vine is.
Okay, all right. Thank you for that. I did see a pink one, like a miniature flower, when I was walking in the neighborhood here.
That one's probably not as cold hardy.
Okay. All right. My next question, carpet grass. I heard your show yesterday talking to the dirt doctor.
Right.
And I have a very small yard and two very small dogs, and mm-hmm. I cannot use compost because they'll eat it.
Okay.
And bring it in the house. So I heard the Garrett Juice Plus.
Uh-huh.
Soak it. I can put it in a bucket and soak it. How often do I do that?
You can put it in a sprayer and just spray on your grass, and maybe once a month. It's not ever going to burn. It'd be a lot easier than putting it in a watering can. I mean, you could do it with the watering can, but it'll take 5 minutes with the sprayer and probably an hour or two, mixing it up just a little bit at a time. But it'll never burn, but I don't think he would benefit from using it more than about once a month.
Once a month, okay. All right, one more question. Here in Kyle, there are new subdivisions going up everywhere, and there is a fence that maybe has maybe over 100 feet of Peggy Martin roses.
Rose, yeah. Uh-huh.
I would like to go and nip one of those and root it. I tried it, but what is the right way to do that?
Well, you want to have mature wood. You don't want the real soft wood. You want the wood that has hardened off. And right now would be a real good time to go take some cuttings. Take several cuttings, strip off the lower leaves. Take your cuttings about 4 or 5 inches long. If they have any buds or blooms on them, cut those off and root them in perlite. You could take an 8-inch pot and probably put about 10 cuttings in one 8-inch pot. Keep it bright, keep it above freezing and keep it moist. And the one other thing, when you take your cuttings, I would soak them in liquid seaweed, the combination of liquid seaweed and Garrett juice. Soak them for about 30 minutes before you put them into the perlite, and you should have about 80% of them root for you. Peggy Martin's pretty easy rose to propagate.
Great. All right. Thank you. Thank you for all this information. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Norma. You have a great day, and call any time, and look forward to helping you. Tony, hang on just a minute. We need to get a break out of the way, and then you'll be next.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening on a beautiful Sunday morning. It's going to be Tony and Leo and Dennis. Tony's first in line. Good morning, Tony.
Hey, Bob. About a year or so ago, a lady asked you how to propagate wisteria, and mm-hmm. you told her to call you back in the fall, and you would explain it.
Okay,
and
well,
I never heard that. I never heard the other half of that call.
Well, wisteria is a vine, and occasionally you will find root sprouts that come off the root system. If they are, you know, as big as a pencil, you can usually dig around the base and get enough roots that it will survive and grow. Most of the time, wisteria is actually grown from cuttings, and this is still a good time of year to take your cuttings. You want to take cuttings that are about 6 inches long. They need to have at least 2 to 3 nodes. A node is where there used to be a leaf, which is now dropped off since true wisteria is totally deciduous in the winter. The stuff they call evergreen wisteria is a whole different plant called Meletia. But a true wisteria, you want to go out toward the tips of the branches. Don't get the real fine stuff. You want something that's, the size of a soda straw or smaller. I think perlite is still about the best material to root in. You can take a, you know, medium-sized pot, say an 8-inch pot. You can probably put 10 or 12 cuttings in there. You want to keep it moist. You want to keep it, if you have a propagating mat that you can put it on, it will root much faster. Yeah. And, you know, good bright light, even though it doesn't have leaves. The other thing is, after you take your cuttings and a little bit, you know, magic marker or something like that, put a dot on, or take a little piece of tiny little piece of wire or something. But when you take that cutting off of a wisteria stem, one end looks pretty much like the other, and it is important that you get it into the perlite right side up. So do whatever it takes so that you literally know which end is up, and it'll take about 6 to 8 weeks for them to start forming roots. Just, again, keep them bright. Bottom heat is good. Keep them moist. Don't be going and trying every other day. But after 6 weeks or so, go lift up gently on your cuttings. When you start feeling resistance, you'll know that roots are starting to form. And at that point, you can transfer them to potting soil and be off to a good start.
Okay, would that be the same for bougainvillea, too?
No, bougainvillea is a totally different creature. Bougainvillea cuttings are done in the hottest part of the year. Wisteria needs to be done while it's dormant. Bougainvillea cuttings are normally done pretty much June through August. Again, take off any buds or blooms. Cuttings a little shorter, no more than about 4 inches long. Do soak them in the same Garrett juice and liquid seaweed mix, and do a bunch of them, and there's some magic to it that I don't know the secret to, and I don't really know anyone who does. But I've taken in July, I've taken, you know, 30 cuttings and had 30 of them root. I've taken 30 cuttings and had one of them root. So don't get discouraged. If one batch doesn't root, wait a couple of weeks and take some more. I truly don't know whether it's the face of the moon or some vagary of the weather or whatever, but sometimes they root real easily and sometimes it's pretty difficult to get them. So do three or four batches over a period of time, and you should get a pretty good take on them, at least one of them.
Okay. Now, can you use rooting hormone, or should you, or, 'cause sometimes when I try cuttings, they seem to rot from the top, cinnamon? Can I use cinnamon on them?
You can use cinnamon if it's a bacterial rot you're getting. My experience with rooting hormone is that the liquid seaweed Garrett juice mix works better than any rooting hormone I've ever tried. I grew up my grandfather using Rutone on things. On softer tissues, I think it actually slows down rooting. Woody tissues, if it's the only thing you do, it probably helps a little bit, but if you go look at it, you'll see the active ingredient is either indole acetic or indole butyric acid, and it's like 0.00015%, which means that there's virtually none of it in there. And I found that the Garrett juice and liquid seaweed do as good or better a job than the rooting hormone ever seems to do.
Okay, should you scrape the bottom of the bark off of them, or
no? But do because it's actually just underneath the bark, which is the very delicate tissue that your roots will arise from. But don't let them sit around and dry out. Once you take in your cuttings, get them into the perlite fairly quickly and keep that perlite moist. Your professional growers, they're going to have a mist bench set up where it's going to come on and miss things every 20 minutes all day long. That's usually not something that we can do at home, but just keep them moist, mist them when you can, and you get a fairly high percentage of them to root if you get them at the right time. And like I say, that's in the case of the bougainvilleas, that's during the warm months, but there's some other magic beyond that. So take more than one batch of cuttings. If you've got a big bougainvillea, you can take a lot of cuttings off of it, and probably should, to keep the size of the plant down a little bit, but it'll make a big difference for you.
Okay, would it help to put the propagate mat outside so you're in the sunlight or light shade?
In summer months on your bougainvilleas, you probably don't need the propagating mat. On your wisteria, just as long as it's bright, doesn't really make any difference inside or out as long as it's above freezing. But I'd ideally like to keep your wisteria cuttings at somewhere around 60 degrees.
Okay. A Chinese pistache, are they as invasive as a hackberry?
I don't think anything's as invasive as hackberry from seeds. The Chinese pistache, the female will produce a lot of seed and you will get a lot of seedlings, but I'm not going to, I hate hackberries. And the Chinese pistache is not that bad, but it's something that I would be reluctant to put in my own yard.
Now that's the one that gets the red berries.
Well, it gets beautiful fall foliage, which is about the only reason to, to grow a pistache. It will have a seed. I don't know that I'd really call it a berry, but yeah, it will have the female one will have a brightly colored seed, but,
are they in clusters?
The only one I ever planted, I got tired of and cut it down after about 3 years. I'm not actually sure on that. I'd have to go look at one to see.
Okay. And the last thing is azomite.
Mm-hmm.
I garden in cattle buckets, the molasses licks.
Yeah, yeah.
How much azomite? Say that's about 25 gallons of dirt.
I'd use half a cup, two-thirds a cup. Never going to burn. You can use as much as you want. It just gets expensive if you use too much of it. But I'd probably, for me, that's about the equivalent of a big handful at a time, and that's what I would use.
Okay, and that's just on the surface or scratch it in?
You don't need to scratch it in. If you're mixing soil up to fill up a new tub, mix some in with it. But once your plants are in and growing, no, just put it on the surface. It doesn't evaporate or go away. The microbes will carry it down into the soil.
Okay. And have you seen ladybug compost around?
I haven't. Ladybug went out of business, and one of the other companies bought the rights to their products. They may still be making it. The price went up so high that we stopped carrying as much of it because New Earth is making a product that's just almost as good. But Ladybug got out of my price range.
I found some in a little nursery, and it says made by New Earth. I think it said New Earth out of Conroe.
You want to be sure, in my opinion, be sure it's not biosolids. New Earth makes a good compost, but about half of what they make, or maybe even more of that, is biosolids based because Saws pays them to take the stuff away.
Because it's very similar to the old bag of Revitalizer.
Mm-hmm.
And I got two bags of it just because I used to use that for my compost tea.
Sure. Sure. No, it's long as it's not biosolid, it should be just fine.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
I appreciate it, Tony. Thank you. All right, let's get our last break of the show in, and we'll come back as time permits and talk to Leo and Dennis.
From the broad ripple spillway to the Waverly Bridge, it's been tall tales, rumors, urban legends, and myths about a world record flathead that some say has never been caught. Sometimes he was spotted in White River with flood, as big as a coffin laying up in the mud. His name is Big Whiskers, and he's the toughest cat that ever fought. As the story goes, the grandpa was a kid. He was checking a trot line by the Southport Bridge. He thought it was snacks, so he leaned down to take a look. The water started to boil, bubble, and churn as the flathead monster came to the surface and turned, headed straight to deep water and got away by straightening the hook. When the word got round by the cat he'd seen, everybody laughed and refused to believe, and they echoed him every time that he walked by. He swore right then to everybody's face, he clear his
name. Oh, Don, I wish we could listen to that one all the way through. I don't know how you find us a great new fishing song every weekend, but put that on the keeper's list. I want to hear that one again and more of it. Let's see. Leo and Dennis, we've got about 6 minutes left in the show, so that's about 3 minutes apiece. Leo, you're first.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, sir.
I've got raised gardens, and there are several of them. I have they're 8x4 feet, and two of them are loaded with large tomato plants and lots of large tomatoes. So I'm afraid that if the first frost comes in and I don't cover it, I'm going to lose them.
Mm-hmm.
I do have some plastic sheeting by Husky or something like that, and it's not very thin. Will that prevent freezing or?
The problem is, if it gets windy, and it's supposed to be really windy tomorrow, that plastic is going to act like a parachute, and your tomatoes are going to wind up either in Corpus Christi if it's blowing from the north, or in Dallas if it's blowing from the south. So I like what they call a floating row cover, and it will give you 5 to 10 degrees of protection, which is normally about all you need. My favorite one is called Insulate. It's the letter N. -SULATE, and it gives you frost protection, and like I say, it'll give 5 to 10 degrees of temperature protection, and I just wrap it around the cages, and it's far better than bed sheets or blankets or other things people use. In calm weather, you can use something like plastic, but typically when a norther blows through, it's when we're going to get our coldest temperatures. And like I say, plastic's just basically a parachute without cords, and it'll be somewhere else pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, what I've done, I've built frames that are adjustable. They can go up as far as 6 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And I can actually staple this. This is like construction plastic that's used for construction.
Okay.
So it's not very, it's pretty sturdy.
And okay, it's probably 6 mil. You can do that, but don't just staple your plastic directly, because even heavy plastic will pull loose from those staples. What you need to do, there's a type of, it's like a nylon tape. It's woven, and you staple through the tape, through the plastic, and into the wood. Okay. That's one way to do it. The other thing is to get some very thin lath strips, and you staple your plastic, but then put a little wooden strip over the top of it and put some small nails through to hold it in place. Just stapling it alone, even heavy plastic, will pull loose on that. But yeah, if you've got a good frame, you can certainly do that. And Leo, I'm going to hold you there because I want to try to get Dennis in before the end of the show. Dennis, you've got about 2.5 minutes.
Okay, real quick. I've got two red oaks planted 10 years ago. Both of them showed some split in the bark. I had Bartlett come out. They said that it's probably healing itself on one of them. We thought we were going to lose that tree, but then it turned around, and the other tree died in a way that I've never seen a tree die. As the oak tree, as each major limb would turn brown, then it would rotate around counterclockwise until all of them are dead. All the leaves are still on there, so I know that tree is going to go away. My wife wants to take the other one down and plant a new one in between the two. It's on the west side of the house, so we like it for shade. Hate to lose the 10 years of growth that we got on the other one.
Sure.
It doesn't shade the part of the house we want. What's the best time of year to put in a new one, and we're thinking about going with Monterey oak?
Monterey oak is definitely a good oak. Best time is 10 years ago, but the second best time is in the cooler cooler months of the year. If you want a faster growing tree, look at Mexican sycamore. Monterey oak is a good tree if you're in San Antonio area. Way up in the hill country, where there was some freeze damage, but mine and Bernie worked just fine. But if you want a tree that'll go three times as quickly, look at Mexican sycamore. It'll make a big tree in half or a third the time Monterey oak will. But if you like oaks, Monterey oak is probably the fastest growing of the oaks. Also look at cedar elm. It grows about the same as the Monterey oak as far as the speed with which it grows. But those are probably going to be my top three trees. I wouldn't plant red oaks. They may be beautiful, but as you've discovered, they're kind of wimps. They die if it gets too dry, die if it gets too wet. A lot of them actually suffered some cold damage. Plus, we do have that issue of oak wilt. And if red oak gets oak wilt, there's absolutely nothing to do. The tree will be dead in 2 weeks. So I would choose one of the others. But right now is an excellent time of year to plant, and I think you'll find nurseries have a pretty good selection of trees on the ground. If you want to talk about that a little further, we can do it next Saturday morning. Right now, it's time for the Pet Show here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.